Hello and hi. Welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is director and co-writer of the indie horror dark comedy, Matt Allen. No, Matt Allen is the director and co-writer. The movie is Hoax. And it is a horror and comedy together usually put me in a weird mental space, and that's where I am right now. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hi, Summer. Thanks for having us on.
So tell me, where did the idea for Hoax come from? Because this is a first of all, beautifully shot movie. It's got the right balance of suspense and, shall we say, snarky humor. And hunting for a mythological legend where half the people on the excursion are claiming, shall we say, bullshit, and the other half are going out there in earnest with specific purpose and goals. And of course, you know, shenanigans ensue. Where did you come up with this particular thing? Let's hunt down Bigfoot, maybe, as an idea.
It was a lot of things together. I grew up in the North Woods of Minnesota. And so, you know, Jason was real. And the woods were always creepy, and I just connected to them. I still, to this day, love to go out in the woods when I go home and just take a walk at night until I get myself creeped out. And there's something about the cryptids that they're never going away. People are always thinking about them. And I was starting to do a whole bunch of research because, I mean, this was a time where sci-fi and some of the other networks were cranking out Bigfoot shows all the time. I wanted to find a way to take all of the films that I watched growing up. You know, I grew up in this golden era of slasher and action films, the early to mid 80s. It was just a wonderful time to be a kid at a theater. And so I wanted to pay respect to those films in a tasteful way and try to connect that with a Bigfoot film and just really kind of do a Bigfoot film that hopefully has some production value that really kind of stands out and sets the forest as a character. And then it all, when I was doing all this research and watching all these documentaries, there was one late night where I couldn't sleep and I went out and watched one. And they asked the question of if there were some backwards people out in the woods and they knew that they had a Sasquatch out there, what lengths would they go to keep it secret, to keep, you know, the media and the city folk and the big game hunters and all that out of their area? And as soon as they said that on the dock, I was just like, oh gosh, there's a little something there. And so kind of did some more research and built together some of the characters and got together with my creative partner, Scott Park, when I thought it was good and pitchable. And he and I went into, you know, treatment and script. And then Scott actually served as the director of photography on the film also. So it was a great team effort between the two of us.
So how long was it from, you know, early stages of the treatment to where you had a shooting script ready to go?
Well, we wrote the first draft and started showing it to people in 2009. Wow. And I had done a short in 2008 that an angel investor kind of took interest in. And we were going to do a version of Hoax in the fall of 2009 for about $2.5 million at that time. And then, you know, the entire financial world just came apart. So that was a tough one for us, but we went back and submitted the script to screenplay competitions on advice of a mentor of mine, and it performed really well at the screenplay competitions and kind of got us a little bit of traction to, you know, start getting in some doors and having people actually pay attention. And we just kept pushing along and then finally found private investors to handle a good portion of the budget, and then Mike Haskins and Mitch Dickman, our producers, took that money in the bank and went to the state of Colorado and got the film incentive funds. And those, you know, got us our aerials and allowed us to shoot an extra week. And it all just kind of came together. It took 11 years from concept to where we're at now. But, you know, I'm not the first person to have to claw and scratch to get their first movie on the docket.
So I'm guessing there was enough frequent positive movement on it that you didn't lose faith that this would ever get made. But that's 11 years is a long time.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I think we knew pretty early on. The script did not change very much. We knew we had an entertaining film. We just had to find somebody that knew and acknowledged everything that we were trying to do, because there's plenty of folks that, you know, have either read or seen Hoax that just kind of scratch their head about, like, you know, what is this? And then there's the true horror fans, which that film is tailor-made for. And then they get it and really get excited. And, yeah, it was... With anything, this whole business is just an up and down ride, and you have to get thick skin. Like, I honestly don't hear the word no anymore, Summer. My brain hears the word next when I hear no. But you just got to keep going.
So when this actually got the green light and you guys started production, did any or much of the story change while you were actually filming the, you know, doing principal photography and putting everything together that you wanted for your film?
I think from a plot standpoint, it didn't change very much. We had approached a producer named Dallas Saunier. Dallas produced Bone Tomahawk at the year before we were getting ready to go. And talked to him, and he gave us one really key piece of advice where originally I think the daughter character in the beginning was supposed to be like a cousin or something a little bit more distant and removed. And he said, you know, make that a daughter or a son so that you can get buy-in from audience as far as, you know, people that have daughters and sons out there are going to feel something. And so we took that note from him and worked that in. And then as far as production goes, I always like collaboration. My, you know, decent idea and somebody else's decent idea can make a good idea or even more. And so we were always changing lines or just kind of figuring stuff out, because you've got eight actors on set and, you know, where are they all going to stand and what are they going to be doing? And, you know, some of that is not always in the script. But I think it was a fluid document all the way through. And that's part of the excitement is, you know, I think Ben and Cheryl and Max and Brian, you know, we were changing stuff on the set all the time. And then one of the exciting parts for me as a first-time filmmaker was the 48 hours that we had with the actors before we started shooting. And they would come in and do last looks for wardrobe and other things. And then they would have notes on the script and to sit and actually go through and not only, you know, tie together their ideas with my ideas, making both of us twice as exciting. But I also got to sit and watch the talent start embodying characters that we had written 8 years prior. So the whole process is fun. And, you know, I did the same thing with Scott, where I think a lot of our previs, we had done stuff that was very extravagant and elaborate. And, you know, coming from maybe a little bit more of a film school dreamer mentality, and then you get on set and realize, oh, my God, we can't do all these shots in a day. What are we going to do? And that was one of my favorite things to do with department heads or talent or anything, and just simply ask them the question, what do you think? And just get it going.
And you have a lot of experienced talent in this production. You have Adrian Barbeau. You have Ben Browder, Brian Thompson, and your composer actually worked with John Carpenter, Alan Howarth. Where did you connect with all these, you know, sci-fi legends?
Well, I mean, I am an absolute fan of I've already said I love the genre. I love the time that I grew up. John Carpenter was a huge part of that. You had talked about earlier before we started recording here with your, you know, love of your vinyl discs and your soundtracks and stuff that you had back in the day. One of my older brothers didn't like horror films, but he loved John Carpenter scores. So those would be playing around the house even before I was old enough to be allowed to watch those films. And then even afterwards. And so that was one of the things we wanted to do right away is I've learned so much in my career from people that have reached a point where they don't give a fuck and they will tell you whatever you want to hear. They're just an open book. I had a couple professors like that at film school. And then we wanted to do the same thing. So we reached out to Alan Howarth, who, you know, has worked with John Carpenter on, I think it's about 6 films, and, you know, started as just an engineer and working with his gear and his keyboards and everything, and then worked up to collaborating with John Carpenter. And everybody knows in the genre that those films, they're great, but they're also great because the scores are just amazing. So, I mean, to be able to incorporate something like that, and I mean, we made a complete concerted effort in the score of Hoax to try to tickle the Carpenter funny bone of the audience, and that was so much fun for me to go in there early on in the process, and we're just throwing different sounds and different themes and different stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And I'm sitting there as a disciple of Carpenter listening to the sounds of Carpenter. And it was hearing my childhood in a modern state, and it was just amazing. And then the same thing we did with Bill Munns. I had a college friend of mine when we were in development say, you got to look up this guy. And so Bill Munns is a creature effects designer. He worked on Swamp Thing and Return of the Living Dead and Beastmaster and a horror film called The Boogans, and did just great physical effects, and then kind of got phased out by VFX, which a lot of people in the industry did. And Bill actually went on to become a published author and considered expert in the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot footage from, you know, the 70s or the 60s. And so that was just the universe telling me, oh my gosh, we need to work with this guy too. And hopefully, you know, there are, I haven't counted them up, Summer. I'm probably going to try to do it this weekend. There's probably just short of 40 Easter eggs in one form or fashion in Hoax. And to be able to work with Bill Munns and Alan Howarth, we're hoping that the audience really appreciates, you know, this film is showing a lot of respect to those seminal films. And we're also trying to use some of the crew members that did work on those films and bring them around and have them work on ours.
Well, the Bill Munns, you mentioned Beastmaster. Beastmaster is a cheesy film that is very, very dear to my heart because everything about that movie is cheesy and it's so endearing and delightful. That is a movie that deserves a Shout Factory release, but...
Oh, gosh, yeah. So Beastmaster, we'll go on a little tangent here for a second.
Okay, okay.
I had a VHS tape when my grandmother bought our family our first VCR for Christmas, and I had one VHS tape that, you know, you remember you could put 3 movies on there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was The Beastmaster, Karate Kid... And I can't remember the 3rd title just offhand, but like I've seen those films so many times that it was literally the classic definition of like wearing out the tape. So yeah, I mean, come on, Mark Singer and John Amos. I mean, that's enough for me right there.
And Rip Torn chewing the scenery every time he appeared on screen. Delightful.
See, that's the thing. I need to go and watch Hoax this weekend and figure out exactly how many homages are in there. Because at first, Scott was trying to hold me back and he's saying, you know, people aren't going to get these. And, you know, what is this? And it's got to be motivated. And, you know, even I think production tried to hold me back a little bit. And then at one point, I think both of them just kind of let up and just like, all right, just lean into it. Like, I don't understand what you're doing exactly, but you keep on saying that people will get these. So, you know, go for it. And yeah, there's so many of those films that there's not a Beastmaster reference in Hoax, I don't think. But if we could do some reshoots and put some ferrets in there, I'd do it.
So are the Easter eggs, are they visual, are they audio, or are they both?
Oh, it's everything. I mean, some of them are just some of them are thematic. And I remember it was, oh, geez, I'm drawing a blank. What was the, was it 8mm? What was the J.J. Abrams film that was supposed to make you think of?
Cloverfield Incident, I think, or?
No.
Oh, Super 8?
Super 8, thank you. Yes. So Super 8 came out right when we were really trying to stir the soup on Hoax, and it made you feel like you were watching early Spielberg. You know, it was a modern take on something, but it just really made you feel you were watching something that, you know, made you think of those other films. And so that's what we really set out to do with Hoax. And so some of those are just thematic. And then there are actual line references. Some of them have already been pointed out on IMDb. And, you know, some of them are tucked in there a little bit more. Like there's a line in a setup from Halloween 2 that we put in. And, you know, I need to count all of these. But here's an indicator of how deep we went with things. And it wasn't just me. Like, our department heads started getting excited about what we were doing. Our costume and makeup effects designer, Midian Crosby, came to me, and we knew that we were getting Adrienne Barbeau to do our cameo. And she said, what do you think about this color for her, you know, her scrubs? And she shows it to me, and my face just lit up immediately. So Adrienne in Hoax is wearing the same color that her main costume in Escape from New York is. It's like a scarlet, burgundy kind of color. So, I mean, there's the opening scene is an homage to, you know, Steve Miner's classic scene in Friday the 13th Part 2. There's actually a musical reference. So I was in there working in Orange County with Alan Howarth on the score, and reached out to Harry Manfredini, who I was connected in, and just told him, we're thinking about doing this setup for the opening scene. We would like to put a little flavor of Friday the 13th somewhere in there musically. What do you think? And yeah, he gave us his blessing and said, go for it. So, you know, we've got a scene that references one of the classic Friday the 13th scenes, and then it's very subtle, but when the guy jumps out, you can hear a little din it, and it's, you know, it's just us saying hi to Harry, which was, it was so much fun. And I wish I had a list of all of the things that we did that you could actually break down, but I think that's part of the fun of doing that, is so that the audience can go find those and probably hopefully prove, you know, production and some of my creative partners that they were right in trusting me and letting me plant as many of these little nuggets as we could in there, because people will identify them and, you know, they won't be lost on the audience.
Nice. Now, the Blu-ray for Hoax is already out. Did you get to cover any of this on the commentary?
A little bit. You know, nothing real specific. It was one of those things where you want to. And there's a couple that I, you know, wish I could have pointed out a little bit more, but I'd never done a Blu-ray before, just like I'd never done any of these interviews until a couple of weeks ago. And generally, you go through those things just trying to not say something stupid. I mean, that's the goal, to just get out and not have something in perpetuity that you're going to just have to cringe about. So, no, we pointed out a couple, and, you know, maybe at some point, I can post something and put a couple of them out there, or I'm sure audience members will keep on putting stuff on IMDb for little trivia and stuff like that. So they did spot one of, there's a Bill Duke line from Predator, that is in this, in Hoax. Brian Thompson delivers it. And I remember actually telling Brian, the background and the full context of the thing, and he just looked at me, and, you know, he's an action guy from that era, and Bill Duke, I think, was just amazing alongside so many of our stars, and he just kind of, Brian just kind of looked at me like, okay, Matt. So, yeah, and that's fun. I mean, that film still to this day I think is perfect, and to be able to, you know, put little nods in there I think is great. And, you know, there's another one that we did which has got some historical context also, where I get clobbered for doing this, it might be a little bit on the nose, but there's a kid in the beginning scene that is referred to by name as Sam, and then turns around at some point while he's drinking by himself, and he's wearing a softball t-shirt that says Loomis on the back. And the cool thing about that is John Carpenter, when he did that in Halloween, was homaging Psycho. So, like, it's so much fun when you see, you know, even mainstream films now are just buttering up to some of the old scenes and giving it love again on screen. And it's fun. It's tricky to do. Some people really don't like it. But, you know, we try to do it in a tasteful way. And there's so many of them in there. I hope people enjoy it.
Well, for you, what was the most challenging or most fun thing that you did while making this movie? Because I have to say, Ben Browder's performance as he slowly reacts to not having his meds is inspired insanity.
Oh, boy. I'm glad you liked that scene. So, it's something, this is in one of the commentaries on the Blu-ray, but we'll cover it again. So that last scene, the destruction of base camp, it's scene 121. We were supposed, it was written as logs and rocks are coming in from all directions, smashing everything to a high holy hell. They're hitting the work lights. The work lights explode in a shower of sparks. And for the Predator fans out there, I will say we were intending on shooting it from across the lake so that you could see a whole bunch of sparks on a lake, like in Predator. Mm-hmm. But so that was all supposed to happen. The light was supposed to fall over, light a tent on fire, and then people come in and put the tent out on fire, and then see the scene that you guys actually see in the film. That was one of our final nights of shooting. We had a hard out for a bunch of our actors where they had to leave town the next day. And we started that production day with about 90 minutes of just full downpour and lightning. And so everyone had to sit in the cars, and there was so much that was supposed to be in that scene, but we kind of just made it as best as we could. That's, I think, to answer your original question, that's some of the scariest and the most exhilarating stuff, is flying by the seat of your pants on an indie film. It wasn't fun because it was my first, and, you know, a lot of that you were just learning things for the first time. But being able to find a way and troubleshoot your way out of things, like, we got out of the cars after it stopped raining and lightning and said, okay, all of those stunts are going away. We're not doing those, because if we try to do any of them, we won't have enough time to shoot the rest of the scene. And so that's, it's exciting, and it's terrifying all at the same time, but it's also some of the stuff that you look back on, and, you know, you just said, I liked seeing Ben slowly losing his shit. And that's also on, you know, Ben Browder as an actor, to be able to do stuff without lines or to have to condense things the way that we did and still be able to convey to the audience, you know, the emotional beats that we need them to understand.
Yeah, because there was one moment in there where he's just standing there with this look on his face that's a combination of, why am I doing this, and what the fuck? And he just cocks his head to one side and all hell breaks loose. And I was just like, that reminds me of a crazy moment from an anime, and I cannot remember which. Just the way he cocked his head. And that entire scene, he didn't say anything. It's all in his eyes and his face. And you see yeah. The moment where he goes from clinging to civility to zero fucks left insanity. And you see the snap. You see the snap and you're like, oh, okay, he's gone. He's gone. Bye bye.
Well, and I really loved it when people enjoy some of the scenes that I kind of cringe at because, you know, either I didn't do my job or the day was crazy and it affected the scene. And so that's a fun one to hear people say good things about. I've got a great story with Ben Browder that involves that. So Ben, it was early on in the shoot. It was when Barnes rushes back in and confronts Paxton, and Singer has to block him, and there's a whole bunch of physicality going on and a whole bunch of arguing. And so all the actors, we'd shot all of our days before that, and they're all pristine and everyone's having a great time. And we got to that one scene, and the actors in the morning were already a little fiery. And I, you know, being a first time director, I'm trying to figure out, what is this? And did I do something? And why is everyone pissed? And, you know, I understand it rains on us a lot up here, but what's going on? And yeah, we rehearsed and did a couple of things, and there was some tension on set, which is great because it shows up in the scene. But myself, just trying to navigate my first feature film as a director, I was scratching my head. And so I went to Ben at lunch, and it was just like, what the hell is that? And, you know, he told me about a couple different things with, you know, actors and difficult scenes and how they approach things and stuff like that. And then just went to the analogy of, you know, it's indie filmmaking. It's battle. It's Waterloo. You know, you just got to get in the trenches and just work your way through it. And so we got through that, and then flash forward to several weeks later, it rained on us all the time. And when we were shooting that scene 121, it was pretty tense. Like, people could feel the pressure. We had a couple crew members that had meltdowns, and it got real tense. And there was a couple hours where I felt that, you know, people really didn't want to talk to me. And it was one of the most lonely moments that I had as a director on that shoot, is I felt it was me and 38 other people that didn't want to talk to me. And you could just feel the tension, and we were still just working through the day. And there was one point where I could feel it. And from about 25 feet away, I just hear, Waterloo! And I look over, and Browder's over there and just, like, waves his hand in a circle, like, let's go. And it was, I so needed to hear it at that moment. It was just perfect. And that's, in a nutshell, that's Ben Browder as an actor and as a person. He was just great.
So what have you been doing for this promotional run? Have you run into fans and gotten their reactions towards the movie?
Dredd set up some screenings around the country at Alamo Draft Houses, and we just screened it, you know, one time, one night. And I went around to all of those, and they were really, really well received. And it's not completely accurate, because those are ringer audience members that are coming to the Dredd series, you know, every month to see what the label is releasing. And they're there to have a good time and enjoy a horror film. So that's been really fun. And then they also, Epic sent up, we did a signing event at Dark Delicacies in Burbank, which was just amazing. I'd never been to that shop. I'd just seen on the internet. And so that was great to meet Dell and everybody else and just kind of meet some more of the fans face to face and get them excited, because honestly, Summer, it's a small indie film. Epic has done a great job putting out a great trailer. And, you know, the two different versions of the key art are just amazing. And now it's really on the audience members that if you like this film, go tell people. And if you like this film, go review it, because there are plenty of people on the internet that have already looked to shit on the film as much as they can. And so we need to counteract that with the people that we made it for, that love horror stuff, love sci-fi stuff, love our actors, love the movies that we're referring to. And, you know, it's going to be the grassroots movement that's going to get this thing going.
Well, I am happy to help out, because, like I said, I enjoyed this movie. The one drawback I felt was the end with Dr. Freeze. That whole scene, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I thought that dragged on a little too long. and maybe was over the top, but if you're aiming for the audience, the folks who like, you know, Hostel and Saw and all that, that's their wheelhouse. That wheelhouse is not my wheelhouse. It's, you know, I am so disappointed by that whole splatter, blood and guts, no story angle to horror movies. I thoroughly enjoyed everything leading up to that. And that whole section at the end was like, okay, I see why we went there. I don't have to love it as much as I loved everything else that came before it. So I understand it, but I don't love it, you know?
It's not everybody does. And that was, we knew that it was going to be risky doing it because it literally is a rope-a-dope. I mean, the whole first three quarters of the film, we intended to just distract people so that we could catch them with that. And it's, and I definitely hear you about the torture porn stuff, which I think it's already been labeled as a little bit, but what people need to realize is, you know, we're really not showing all that much. If anything, you see a hell of a lot more on even network television these days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly referring to a horror film from the 70s. That I remember exactly where I was when I saw that film and was just like, you know, why? And why are they doing this? And why is this scene going on so long? And now, oh my God, why are you now showing ECUs of an eyeball? Like, please make it stop. And that's, we set out to, you know, honor that film and that scene specifically. And then, you know, I just talked earlier about some of the challenges of, trying to, you know, convey your vision and have it actually whatever percentage show up on the screen. And without trying to sound too defensive, that cabin was pretty difficult from a production standpoint. We had an actor whose agent needed to get him out early to go work on a series that he was just offered a job on. And we had to shoot it with about a day and a half less time. And we were also, some of those actors that are in that scene weren't in town yet because they weren't scheduled to be shot for a day and a half later. So some of that is a little confusing, Summer, and I wish the reveal on things, it was intended to be a little bit more so that it could be understood and not completely out of left field. But just like I said with, you know, the finale climactic scene at base camp, you know, sometimes you just get a percentage of what you thought you were going to do and hope that it makes sense and then hopefully is entertaining afterwards. And I'm still proud of the scene itself. If anything, it does what we wanted it to do, maybe a little bit too effectively.
Well, most of that,
and we wanted to push the boundaries a little bit.
Now, most of that was practical effects, right?
It's all practical.
Yep. So I will give you the golf clap on that, because practical effects in horror movies are overlooked, and you need to feel that visceral goop, even if it is, you know, Jell-O mixed with crushed fruit cocktail and thrown on a piece of rope. There's something more tangible to the practical effects. So golf clap there.
And we do a little bit of both too, where, you know, we don't want to get too specific, but there's a scene where we cut away from that location to another location and something happens to the cameraman that is almost all off screen and sound design. And that is one of the scenes that gets the most reaction from people that we've showed it to so far. It's just like, oh my gosh, that mm-hmm. scene. And I love that kind of stuff because that's, you know, practical effects. And then that kind of filmmaking where it's theater of the mind, that's the kind of stuff that they used to do before Hostel. And that's why it used to work. And it's always scarier to put it in the audience's head than just, you know, in their eyeballs. But I think we did a decent mix of both. And yeah, Midian Crosby was our makeup effects, and her husband, Joshua Adams, they did all of that work. And once again, you know, we're probably planning to have 4 days to shoot it, and we ended up having, you know, 2.5. So they did a wonderful job also with just you know, all the prep work and getting everything ready to go. I mean, the stuff that we put on Max Decker's leg, you know, that takes half a day to set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they did great. And then the cast members just did a wonderful job. And I don't think that scene's going to be for everybody. Some people will like it and some people won't. And some people will like twists and some people won't. And, you know, that's one of the cool things about art also, Summer. Like, I was just talking to one of my college friends this morning who just watched the film last night. And stuff that I love, he hates. And stuff that I hate, he loves. And so that's art for you. It's kind of the freeing thing, too, where I just have to let the thing go out in the world. And I had a guy at the Dallas Alamo screening that we did ask me this super deep, in-depth question about philosophies and stuff that he was reading into the twists and the characters at the end. And I just looked at him like, yeah, John, I don't think we were trying to be that deep, but that's the great thing about art. Like, you're already reading shit into it. So it's fun to kind of have it be out there and see how people are going to react to it. You know, if they love it, if they hate it, you're still getting a reaction out of them. And I'm just happy to have a film that people are seeing enough so that they can critique it or love it or whatever.
Well, look at it this way. If they're arguing about it, you did something right, because if it was just middle of the road, they wouldn't talk about it. But you did something and you got them talking about it. So that's a flag right there.
And we knew, you know, I won't give away too much, but, you know, Scott had a saying that this is the biggest Bigfoot movie that doesn't have much Bigfoot in it ever when we were writing the thing. So.
Well, I have recommended it to folks because it is a very entertaining film. The performances, especially Brian Thompson and Ben Browder, they are hilarious. Shoshana yeah. Bush, her character, I called it a personality journalist. She had me cracking up every single time with how fast she switched between serious journalist and, oh my God, where's my latte? That just... She and I laughed over that too, but
I think that's one of the fun things that Scott and I wanted to do in the beginning, where, and it's what I love about horror and genre films, is you can make political or social commentary or commentary on whatever without getting up on a soapbox to do it. So, like, you know, Ben and Shoshana's characters, it's really influenced by what reality television did to us as a society and what it did to production also, and just seeing what people will do on different sides of the camera and kind of that duality of, you know, you can even take it further from when Scott and I originally wrote it, now that social media is such a thing. And, you know, people, I hear all my friends all the time talk about laughing at everybody's perfect life on social media, where you only get to see the awesome dinner or the perfect workout, or here's my entire family in front of this awesome sunset. You don't get to see that family bitching at each other, you know, at the dinner table and all sorts of different stuff. So that was something that we wanted to work in thematically, just kind of the different sides of people, their public persona and their private persona, and then also just what pursuit of fame and notoriety does to people. And that goes, you know, that's all the way back to, you have to give it to George Romero. Like,
yeah,
I mean, that guy knew how to make very entertaining films that either if you watch them again or maybe gave it a little bit time for your brain to marinate beyond all of the blood and gore that they were showing you, just like, oh, like, there's a little something to say there.
So are you taking a breather before jumping into your next film?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have been joking for the last month with those questions. My initial reaction was, my answer was always, I need a padded room, and that's going to be my future. I should have 6 scripts at the ready to either pitch or produce. And with the 11 years of trying to get Hoax done, it was such an obsessive undertaking that I have films that are or stories that are in treatment form, but, you know, not anything that we could really roll with right away. So I'm going to take September and keep touring around and do some film festivals and then go to a football game and kind of decomp a little bit. And then Scott and I are going to get back in a room in October and start working again. But I needed to feel the full arc of this experience and, most importantly, the pause at the end of it, because I threw myself against the wall several different times just at the end getting this film finished, and I'm going to need to pick up the pieces for a little while.
Well, where can people find you online so they can follow your adventure with the next Instagram perfect photo shoot you'll do on the set of your next film?
Well, that's something that I need to work on, Summer. I am not much of a social media guy. Rum River Productions does have a Facebook page, and Hoax has Hoax the Movie Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And against my entire being, I'm going to break down and get an Instagram page here probably today. And I don't know what the name of that will be, but we can update people. But yes, I will put my perfect shots from set and, you know, my perfect script notes in like a cabin or a Starbucks or something like that. And no, I have to join the rest of everyone else. That's, if your audience wants a what would you not know about myself, I had a flip phone until last November and then finally had to get rid of it because I needed direct access to my emails when we went into the sale process. And so I'm slowly entering this new millennium. And we will see. I'm going to go look up and see if the real Slim Maddie Allen is available. And I think that's probably going to be my Instagram handle.
Well, as someone who only gave up her Motorola StarTAC many, many years ago out of just threats from the carrier for not supporting the phone anymore, I feel you. That's still the best phone I ever had.
I miss it. Like, honestly, 9-10 months of having this thing, it's already melted my poor little brain. I was trying to hold the modern world back, and now it's got me. It's funny, so you being a sci-fi fan will appreciate this. I tried to tell people beforehand that there's a Star Trek The Next Generation episode, and I can't remember the title, but it's when Wesley and all the young kids are playing a video game where you try to catch a bunch of discs, basically.
Yes, they're addicted to the game.
It has the little visors on, and it's like stimulating their pleasure centers. It's almost like a Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where the story is told from the POV of the people that haven't been taken over yet. And that is exactly how I felt the last several years when I still had my flip phone and would watch people walk around like just oblivious to everything. And it eerily made me think of that episode. And now I'm one of everybody. So.
Yep. Instead of Donald Sutherland pointing at you and screaming, he's holding up his smartphone, forcing you to watch a cat video off YouTube.
It's funny because I joked with Scott that I want to shoot a short film. This is my perspective up until I got rid of the flip phone, especially at airports. I just felt like I was wearing like neon or something because people would just stare at me. And I told Scott I want to do just a silly short spoof and have all the people and do the Donald Sutherland setup and have everybody just go, oh, and point up and have the character be holding a flip phone because that's how I felt when I was out in public with that thing.
You need to do it. You need to do it. Well, Matt, thank you so much for sharing your fandom and your passion for all things horror and sci-fi today.
Thank you for carrying the torch, Summer, and I appreciate, you know, the praise and the criticism. Like, all of it is great to hear from people, and, you know, folks really need to just tell your friends or, you know, blog about it or post about it or whatever. It is available on demand on everything except for Redbox. They'll have to search for it, but it is going to be out there. And we need to just keep the momentum going with the film and get the real passionate folks that we made it for to tell their friends, because that's our target audience.
Cool. Well, we will help to spread the word. Hoax from Epic Pictures Dread Presents is available today on video on demand. Go have fun watching this one, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Welcome to Tales of the Black Badge, a Wynonna Earp fan podcast. WynonnaEarpPodcast.com. Thanks again for checking in, and I hope you all take care. I told that devil
to take you back. Tales of the Black Badge, presented by Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV.
Hi guys, this is Tom Allison, and I play Pree on Killjoys, and you're listening to A Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hi, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and now I have one of the other leads from our new favorite horror dark comedy Hoax, Cheryl Texera, and she plays Dr. Ellen Fries, who is the serious scientist that is brought onto the production to lend her expertise in primates in determining what they are tracking. And as we said before, this group goes out into the woods and shenanigans ensue. And Cheryl's character turns out to be one of the badasses. And I'm so happy about that. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Summer. I'm excited to chat a bit about Hoax. This will be fun.
Well, your character gets to work on screen with Adrienne Barbeau, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
How, you know, legend there. And
I know.
And then when the group gets out into the woods to do all of this research and setting up of tests and video traps for this creature, which they believe is Bigfoot, your character is trying to keep an open mind, whether or not this is a real creature, whether or not it's something that's in her specialty, you know, dealing with primates. But she's also got a little bit of crazy going on around her, and she's trying
a little bit, yeah,
trying not to let affect her work.
Yeah, it's I like to believe that Ellen is, because she's a doctor, she is the primate specialist, she wants to believe that, hey, there's a possibility that there's a thing like Bigfoot out there, but because she's so much more into cold, hard facts, there's absolutely a bit of cynicism that goes into even taking this trip on. And obviously, like, she goes simply for the money to start. And then, of course, yeah, things get a little crazy with Rick Paxton, played by the brilliant Ben Browder, and just how, you know, obsessed he is with getting a good story for his TV show, because he needs to revive his career as a TV producer. It's almost like at any cost of, you know, any possible human beings going missing, it's like, well, does Rick have his shot? You know what I mean? So it's just, it gets a little crazy for sure.
And like, your character and I think Brian Thompson's character are looking around when people start dropping like flies. The reaction that Ellen had was, are you kidding me? He's dead. Why are we going to look for him?
Right? I do feel like whenever you're filming like a horror, there is the element of, wait a second, like, these people are dying. It's not like, oh, you know, someone's off into the woods, maybe hanging with a friend and we don't see him for a day or two. It's like, no, like, straight up, there's evidence that like the people are dropping like flies. So yeah, that's extremely disturbing if you put that into like a real context. Like, what would you do? You know, how would your mentality be at that point?
Well, that's just it. Your character is the one who's having the sane reaction. Everyone else is just sort of going nonchalantly going, oh, well, you know, that's extra food rations for me or something like that.
Right. Exactly. It's like, yeah, there is a bit of, you know, like some of the characters are a bit more like they're selfish in the sense that the characters are, in the sense that it's like, well, what am I still taken care of? That's fine. It's like, it's insane.
And the thing I like about it, because it served up for me, from my perspective, it served up a flag of a red herring, because, you know, Paxton's character, his cameraman, his sound guy, all of his tech people, they seem to be just going along with this as if they're filming a hoax. So people disappearing, they're like, yeah, it's part of the setup. Paxton set this up. He told them to go, you know, over the next ridge and have a smoke or something, and we'll catch up with them later. So they don't believe they're in any danger until it's too late. And I thought that was a wonderful take on it. But then you've got the survivalist who's looking for his daughter. You've got you who's actually on a real scientific quest because, you know, grant money's hard to come by, and the bodyguard played by Brian Thompson, which is hilarious, and Shoshana Bush's character, the was it Bridget Powers, the
person, so great,
the personality journalist.
Oh my god, she's really the one that comes to mind when you're thinking of who's like the character that is like, am I fine? That's what I think is so fun to watch with Shoshana, is she's that character that is bringing so much comedic relief to this insane story that's going on, because she's like, you know, she's more of like a chain smoker drinking her way through this camping in the woods because it's the furthest thing that her character would ever want to do. And then also I also love how Dano's character as Justin, like the camera guy, because like Justin has that moment where he's the one filming all of this and he's like, why in the world did I take this summer job? So I love what Matt Allen did with the script and with the direction was, it's a horror, and I do feel like it would absolutely be under the umbrella of horror and not a horror comedy, but there is still so much comedic relief in it with some of the characters, and I love that.
Well, there's so many comic moments, and you know, to me, the snarky dialogue, the looks of disbelief and are you kidding me, that go back and forth. Now, you have a comedy background. Shoshana has a comedy background. I think Hutch also had a comedy background. Did that help you guys? Did you guys do any like improv with the comedic elements, or how did that work?
So I don't, I know for myself, I've stuck pretty close to the script because Ellen didn't really have so many comedic moments per se. But in regards to Hutch and Shoshana, I'm not 100% sure, but it wouldn't surprise me at all, because those two characters in particular were quite a bit of the comedic relief, and they're both very funny and very witty people. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if there was a bit of improv. I know that there was. With other characters, they would stay in the scene. I think, I can't remember if it was part of the script, because I feel like it was improvised in the moment, but there was a moment where we're about to go looking for Peter Moore, played by Skylar, who, let me see if I can get his last name, Skylar Denham, who is a local actor and did such a great job. His character, not to do any spoilers, we go looking for him. And there was a scene about the bear spray, and Brian Thompson and Max Decker, who plays Cooper Barnes, they have a little bit of banter back and forth about the bear spray. And I don't believe that was scripted. In fact, I know at least some of it, if some of it was, not all of it was, and it made it into the film. So that's always fun to watch.
So what was your approach to playing Ellen for this role? Because it's a little bit serious, but there's also a little bit of action for you in there too.
Oh, I love that. That's what got me so excited about it. Yeah, Ellen is definitely more cerebral and methodical in the sense that she's not someone that would like, you know, she's not there to have a good time. She's more there to get whatever facts that she can get and get back home as safely as possible. And what I love about her is she's not just this one level, this one note character. She's going through a lot of personal stuff. When we meet her, she's going through a divorce and she's on the brink of losing her business because her veterinary business is in so much debt that she's kind of this person who's completely down on her luck and then thrown in with this, you know, group of characters who everyone's kind of there for their own personal reason, including Ellen, and she's very much there just to get in and get out. And then when these things, these crazy, terrifying things start happening, it forces her into that role of we need to get out as alive as we possibly can. And then, and then the bit of like the running and the action and a bit of the physicality, particularly at the end, which I won't give any spoilers, was the most intense days of filming for sure, because it wasn't only a night shoot. It was, you know, the psychological effect of what is happening in those final moments for her. It's intense and it was such a thrill to play.
So what part of the character or the script appealed to you most? What was the moment where you said, oh, this is what I want to play?
Yeah. The part that I can't really talk about, the last bit of it. I love, right? Like I love the opening of it. I love what Matt Allen did with all of the characters, how they are truly defined characters. They're all unique. They all are on their own personal journeys. And they're developed in that way. But I loved that. But what I really loved is the arc of Ellen coming from, you know, she's just a doctor trying to pay her bills, trying to get through life, having a tough time and a tough go at that. She's not Miss Sunshine at all. She's very more matter of fact, which is not the type of character that I typically play, because I do more comedy. I'm more of like the sunshine, fun, bubbly type. So that appealed to me immediately. But then to see her arc and to see just truly how she steps up and how badass she gets at the end and how ruthless she gets in some of the moments, that did really excite me and make me excited to do it.
Now, have you done any horror before this? Because, and you know, without spoilers, at the end of the movie, the climax of the movie, you are dealing with some, shall we say, scary individuals and a lot of gory, goopy, covered practical effects. Well, I don't want to say what they are, but they're people parts.
No, scary individuals played by, to give them a shout out, two brilliant actors. Like at the end, we get to see Christopher Soren Kelly and Karen Slack, and they are so, so enjoyable to watch. And also Sean Rickle as well. Oh my gosh, these actors just completely, just to play opposite them, as terrifying as they were, was such a thrill. But yeah, there was definitely a psychological moment where I can't remember. I feel like we had to do a couple reshoots at the end, like for one of the end shots. And I had to go back into the area that we're very much dancing around in this topic of discussion. I had to go back in, and it was so bizarre standing outside before walking in, where that's the moment where I'm like, oh, I remember things were not very fun in there. Like you're filming a movie, but it's still scary. So I have done one other horror film, which has made quite a few rounds. It's called Bunny Man. It was, oh my gosh, it was so long ago at this point. It was like 12, 13 years ago. I wasn't even a SAG actor yet. And that was a crazy shoot in and of itself. Yeah.
So where do you, I'm trying to dance around this without going into spoilers. where do you feel Ellen's biggest moment was, and how did you feel digging into that?
Well, I don't know necessarily if I realized it in the moment, simply because when you are filming, you're focused on let's get the shots, let's have the intensity be right. But there, I feel like I could say this. There's one moment with a frying pan, and that's all I'll say. And I feel like that moment, even it's so funny because like I was there, I shot it. I remember doing that, but watching it back on screen, I was like, oh, that's pretty intense. This is all right. She's going through something. She's letting some stuff out.
So have you and your family and your friends, have you like sat down and watched this with like popcorn and beer? What was the reaction? Yeah. What was the running commentary?
Other than that's intense. Like what happens at the end there, that took a turn. That was a big one. people say quite a bit. It's like it ramped up very quickly at the end. And then it's just like, you know, and then it's nonstop too. You know, you get introduced to all of these characters in this situation and you think you understand where it's going and you think you have a pretty good grasp. And then it takes this hard left turn into, I would say, into crazy town where it's like, what is happening? And it's just like heart racing and you have no idea who's going to get out, if anyone's going to get out. That was extreme. And do you know the most, well, it's so funny. It's like, we can't talk about it because I don't want to give any spoilers away, but the, you know what? I'm not even going to say it because if I say it, it might be a bit of a spoiler, but there's a moment I'll simply say with Karen, I'll say that, which was nuts. And we only did, go ahead.
I believe I know the scene you're talking about and yeah, yeah.
Right. We only did two takes because I don't know if it was simply they got the shot or I specifically remember saying, I can't do much more of these. So I'll say that.
Okay. Totally understood. Yeah. Now, you mentioned that your next project is a science fiction project. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's so exciting. I just got, I literally just got an email from the director, producer, Paul Salamoff. So I shot a sci-fi feature called Encounter that stars Luke Hemsworth that's coming out October 1st. And basically it's about a group of friends who uncover an otherworldly object in this very rural field. And they soon discover that this object might not be what they initially think it is.
So who's sending that out and how do I get to see it?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So Octane Entertainment and Vega Baby, they are the distributor and the sales rep. And it's coming out October 1st.
Cool. Because like I said, indie sci-fi, indie horror are... I don't know if passion projects isn't the word, but I have a great interest in them because those tend to be more adventurous where it comes to storytelling these days. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, you're going to get more of those per year than from the studios, especially, I don't know if it's just budgets or, you know, people are less willing to take a risk in an unproven franchise or something, and indie films are just saying, yeah, go for it. And sometimes you swing and you miss, and sometimes you get a really, really good, fun movie out of it, like this one.
Oh, yeah, seriously, and Hoax was absolutely incredible. Yeah, so amazing. And then Encounter is really exciting because it's the same thing. It's a story, and it's so much more... Like Hoax, it's so much more focused on the characters and what's happening between them than it is on like special effects and let's, you know, and whatnot, which I love.
Cool. So where can folks find you online to follow your next endeavors in the science fiction, horror, or comedy fields?
For sure. You can find me on Instagram at cheryl.texera. And then I'm on the Twitter and the Facebook, and you can just kind of do a Google search of that. Yeah. And then I also, coming up later this year, I'll be on the season premiere of Disney's Sydney to the Mac. So that'll be fun.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Cheryl, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your memories and your experiences with Hoax with us.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for having me. It was so fun.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this. Well, since both of those interviews have me running longer than I usually go, this out is going to be short and sweet. The only comment I'm going to make is that I was pleasantly surprised to find out that Paul Salamoff is the producer for that new sci-fi feature that Cheryl mentioned, Encounters. A long, long time ago, I interviewed Paul for an indie comic he put together, sort of a science fiction, deep space interstellar take on the Frankenstein monster called Discord. I don't know if that interview is still online, but I believe the show notes and the details about the interview and about Discord are still on the site, so go check those out. If you want to call in, the number is 602-635-6976. The email address is summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, and Player FM. And if you could, please leave us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Stitcher if you happen to use those services. Positive reviews give us a boost. So if you can, thank you in advance. And follow us on Twitter @SliceOfSciFi. And yes, I do chat up people who chat at me about geeky things like, why hasn't there been decent Blu-ray releases of The Beastmaster and Dog Soldiers yet? I'm waiting. You can follow us on Facebook and on YouTube. We're Slice of Sci-Fi in both locations. Again, thank you to our Facebook administrator, Neil. He's doing a bang-up job over there, keeping the Facebookers interested and curious and supplied with a steady stream of sci-fi geekery. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can check out other interviews, check out reviews we've done for movies and TV shows and graphic novels every now and then. And you can weigh in with your own rating on a review if you happen to disagree with what one of us here has done. I have a feeling that people are going to, what's the word I'm looking for? Contest my opinion of Hoax. It's not a bad movie at all. I don't know why so many people on IMDb are angry with it. I'm like, really? Seriously? Have you seen the movie Liquid Sky? Have you seen the movie Battlefield Earth? Tell you what, go watch both of those and then get back to me about what you think about Hoax. We'll call it even. I'd like to thank everyone who is helping support the show here. Your pledges through Patreon and your donations through PayPal really do help keep the lights on here. If you'd like to add your support, you can become a new patron over at patreon.com/sliceofscifi, or you can just send a couple bucks this way every now and then using PayPal. paypal.me/scifisummer is the link. And to everyone who uses all sorts of various methods, my heartfelt thanks to you. I'd like to also throw a shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the theme music here. If you want to find out more about them, listen to more music by them, head on over to their website, sci-fried.com. But that will do it for this extra long episode. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week, and I already teased who the guest will be if you were listening very carefully. Take care.